Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Developer Express. Become a UI superhero with DevExpress, controls, and libraries. Deliver elegant .NET solutions that address customer needs today by leveraging your existing knowledge. You can build next-generation touch-enabled solutions for tomorrow. You can download your free 30-day trial at dx.hanselminutes.com. That's dx.hanselminutes.com. Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today I'm talking with Alina Hall. She's formerly a software engineer at Microsoft Research. She works on Azure and big data and loves functional programming and all kinds of distributed systems. And I'm happy to be talking with you today. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you, Scott. How are you?
I'm great. We're doing this over the holiday season, which means that we probably need to spend more time not working.
We are. Merry Christmas, everyone.
Merry Christmas to you. But we have a lot of fun working on this kind of stuff. So you're a lot like me. You just can't stop because you have so much fun, right?
Right. I'm a very naturally curious person. So I like to discover new things and learn them during the holiday season and every time. So I'm a big fan of functional programming and distributed systems.
I met you, it's been several years now, but I've always thought of you as a functional person. But I don't, did you start out functional?
I did not. I think we've met at .NET Fringe 2015 first in Portland. And I was given a talk about F-Sharp and Embrace framework, which is a framework for cloud computations in a functional way. And at that point, I was doing functional programming already for a few years. Yeah. But I started as a Java and C-Sharp engineer. So I did have to break my mind and go into functional programming from object-oriented background.
But in 2015, you know, when you were actually on the board of the F-Sharp Software Foundation, you said you were already thinking about functional for a few years. When you did your master's degree, were you doing functional? Were you writing Haskell and things like that?
So Scala and F-Sharp were my first functional programming languages. And I have decided to learn them to just understand functional programming in general. Because previously, I've just been exposed to languages like Java and C#. And of course, it definitely broke my mind at first. Nothing seemed intuitive for the first few weeks. But as I got through the concept, sometimes reading the same article or chapter or of the book for 10 times, I came to find that actually, some of the concepts are more intuitive than it seemed at first. Yes, they were different from those that I've been used to, and that's why it was hard at first to wrap my head around them. But in general, they make sense. So yeah, I've used them during my master's too.
Are you familiar, of course, with the Dvorak keyboard?
Yeah, I am.
Are you a Dvorak person?
I'm not.
So I feel like I've got a buddy, you know, Phil Hack.
Yep.
And he's always telling me that I should switch to Dvorak. And he always tells me it'll break your mind for a few weeks. Yeah. And then it'll be this glorious, wondrous future. Like, and you'll be living in a parallel universe like Neo in the Matrix. Is functional?
Yeah, I have a feeling that this is something similar. I have not tried this keyboard, but I agree that, yes, at first, when you are exposed to any new concept like this with previous experience in a different world, it will change your worldview. And at first, you will try to program using for and while loops and do assignments of mutable variables, but then you realize that, okay, this is not how I should think about it. I should think about it as data pipelines and transformations and not actually assigning something to a variable, but having values that then return other values and having small set of functions that sometimes you have to use some explicit wrapper around side effects so that your program knows how to handle them and how to communicate with external world correctly. So functional programming is just a different abstraction from the foundation up. And it goes in parallel with this imperative programming world. And it mm-hmm. also can be used for general purpose programming.
What do you feel about the relationship between, and I'll just use these two languages, C-sharp and F-sharp? Is it a competition, or is it just, you know, brothers and sisters or stepbrothers? Like, or do you think that are there F-sharp people that just think that F-sharp should, and I forgive me for using this word, should win?
I feel like they are a preference. Basically, mm-hmm. people can prefer one or another. But I feel like mm-hmm. C-sharp is slowly taking some of the features of F-sharp into itself. Mm. So, like pattern matching. I feel like it's slowly taking this feature into C-sharp. So, F-sharp seems cleaner to me. Mm-hmm. It makes me discover bugs really much more quick than in C-sharp. Mm-hmm. We basically, I can build prototypes in F-sharp, not depending on what language I finally will implement the production solution with. I've heard many stories that people who are using, for example, Java for their production solution still implement the first initial prototype in F-sharp. Because,
really?
Yes, because it's much easier to first build out your logic and specify all the possible outcomes and basically make sure that you're building what you really should be building.
Interesting. Do you feel that the move of F-sharp recently to support like .NET Core and .NET Standard, I'm sure that's all a good thing, right?
This is definitely a good thing. And I think this brings F-sharp into more wide usage compared to like previous years, because like right now I have a Mac and I'm using F-sharp with Mono on it, and mm-hmm. I use F-sharp in Kubernetes in my services, so I'm working with it like an open source language, and basically I can interact with any open source technology with no limitations. So I feel like .NET Core support is the next step in this process too.
And it kind of seems like a natural place for the F-sharp community, because, you know, .NET people and C-sharp people are open source and becoming more open source, but F-sharp people feel like they've always been very intensely focused on open source. So for the ability for F-sharp to interact with other open source distributed systems is super important. And I know there's a bunch of distributed systems and technologies that you're interested in.
Yes. I am currently working with a lot of distributed systems technology, like Cassandra, Spark, Kafka, and I'm using F-sharp and Scala to interact with these technologies. So,
What are some of the technologies that you've plugged F-sharp into and been surprised that it worked so well?
For example, Cassandra. Simply, when you are creating a Cassandra cluster, first thing that comes to your mind, okay, so you can use Java or Scala with Cassandra because they're basically a native support in the Cassandra driver. But as you may discover, F-sharp is also supported. And then I just tried to check how smooth is the support and whether everything works. And I've discovered that it is really easy to do that, and it's very smooth. There are no issues. In my recent demos at KubeCon in December in Austin, I was showing basically how to write F-sharp jobs to run on Cassandra to populate your Cassandra cluster that is running on Kubernetes with stateful sets. So it's really amazing to see that everything works together. Functional programming, distributed systems, containers.
A lot of people are watching all of this happen from the outside. They might be working on, you know, .NET 3 or .NET 4. Maybe their company works a little bit more slowly. They're not thinking about containers. And they might be a little bit overwhelmed, frankly, and feeling like, I'll try Kubernetes or I'll play with it on the weekend, and then I'll play with something else the next week. And by then, it's already changed. Do you think things are moving too fast?
They are definitely moving. They're moving fast. But I feel like it's natural evolution of technology. And at some point, I mean, when technology becomes more popular, you have to look at it because it might be the next standard. So I feel like Kubernetes is becoming the next standard for services for running distributed systems that you build on top of it. So if your application is based on old standards that works good, it's fine. But if your application needs to be more distributed, you should definitely look into Kubernetes and see what benefits you can get using it, because it supports many of the things that previously we needed to think about implementing manually. Like if you have a service that needs to be replicated and always available, you can easily indicate these parameters in your configuration, and Kubernetes will make sure that your service is scheduled to run exactly this many instances and recover any failures that can occur in the meantime, mm-hmm. and many other features.
You probably know that I've been learning about Kubernetes over the last year, and I've been doing some stuff with Raspberry Pis. And a couple of weeks ago, I had Alex Ellis on. He's a Docker captain, and he's a big fan of using Kubernetes on Raspberry Pis, and you know, learning about it kind of in my own little lab. But and then I did, of course, some stuff in Azure. But one of the things that I realized that a lot of us who are doing kind of Hello World demos and learning about the basics of Kubernetes are doing, mm-hmm. is we're kind of ignoring the database part.
Yeah, because it's tricky. Because previously, just like a year ago, we didn't have stateful sets, which is a concept in Kubernetes that allows you to run stateful applications. Mm-hmm. Right now, we have this concept, and it really simplifies how we manage storage with Kubernetes. Mm-hmm. So we can of course, mount a persistent volume, but stateful sets help us with automating all of this underneath. And we just define our template with the persistent volume claim, and it manages all the mounting automatically and makes sure that if something happens, it will remount it. And you can specify settings to make sure that, let's say, if you have multiple instances of the application, that none of them are scheduled on the same node because it might be not really reliable. Actually, in my demo, I was showing exactly that. When I deployed Cassandra on Kubernetes and mounted Azure disks to it, managed disks, and showed mm-hmm. how if something happens to a container, it restarts, and then data is not lost. So basically, it helps us to manage this state.
Maybe you could help me better understand stateful sets. I've heard that a number of times. You've said it a couple of times, and I still don't quite understand what how that relates. Like, which part of my app is supposed to be totally stateless and to be fired up and shut down instantly, and then whether a stateful set is going to make my site less likely to scale.
Okay, I see what you mean. So containers in general, when you think about containers, they're basically meant as stateless services. Mm-hmm. When we have some sort of important information that we can't allow to be lost, we mm-hmm. must have some sort of persistent storage. Because if something happens to a pod, everything can happen. It can die. Mm-hmm. We will lose our state with usual deployment or replica set in Kubernetes. So we have to have persistent volumes attached and manage our state, manage our data in a stateful way. So Kubernetes has this concept of storage class that you can choose from. So I know that I played around with this on Azure, and it has managed disks or file storage or some default storage classes. You can choose what mm-hmm. type of storage you can have for your pods. And then in the template definition of your service, like Cassandra service, mm-hmm. We have an additional section, which is called volume claim templates. And there we indicate that we want each pod to start with a mounted storage of the type of the storage class that we have chosen. We are also indicating the amount of storage, some like 1 gigabyte or how many gigabytes you want. And then when each pod starts up, it requests the storage waits for it to be provisioned and attaches it to the node it resides on. So basically, if something happens to this container after a while, the volume will be remounted and data will be still there and not lost.
Okay, so let me see if I can repeat some of that back to you and like paraphrase it, sure. And you tell me if I got it right.
Of course.
Okay, so if you're like an administrator or an IT department who is going to make Kubernetes, make hardware available to Kubernetes, you have lots of different options, and you can give them storage. And the administrator can say, I have different classes of storage, different things, and it could be different speeds or different quality of service or different whatever. And I can say, I've got an Azure disk available. I've got an unmanaged Azure disk available. I've got a whatever. Okay. And my app might need different kinds of storage. Like I might just need temporary storage, or I might need super fast storage, and I need you to hold on to it so that if I go away, the storage exactly. doesn't go away.
Yes.
Okay. So then I describe in my basically in my pod that or in my description, what's it called? What's the where am I describing this? How am I making these declarations?
There is a file. You can have a YAML file with a definition of your stateful set where you indicate all of these parameters.
Right. Okay, so then I'm describing in there what I want, and then persistent volumes can then say, well, I need this much space, I need these ways to talk to it, I need this class of storage,
yes.
and I need to mount it, and then I think the term is reclaiming, is that right?
Yeah. So basically, if we look even deeper, what is happening when we perform the command kubectl-create-f my stateful set dot YAML, we will start... noticing that, okay, so there is the first pod creating right now. And when we look into persistent volume claims, we can also check them using kubectl. We can do kubectl get PVC, which is a persistent volume claim. We can see that it starts to get created. So it's like a request for storage. And then after we have this request for storage, we can look into persistent volumes, which is kubectl get PV. And then we will notice that it is also starting to be created. As soon as it's done, our pod will start pulling the container image and we'll be ready and running. And then same stuff for the next pod. And one of the good things about stateful set is that all the pods are created in order, because for some distributed systems, it's really important. Like for Cassandra, basically, you need the nodes to be aware of some existing nodes in the cluster, because you have to indicate the seed nodes, which is the way new nodes can join the cluster and discover other nodes. So stateful sets help with state and with ordering of creation and deletion and updates. So that is really useful.
When you're creating these systems like this, when you're asking for storage classes, you're asking for disks. I've found in all clouds, I mean, I know mostly more about Azure, but I've found in every cloud that there's sometimes a lot of latency. Like you think you're asking for a real disk, but it's not real. It's out there somewhere else on a network, and you're talking over HTTP or something else when you think you're talking to a real disk. Can that be a problem with scale?
Usually not, because for me, in my experience, it happens pretty fast, and you can watch that your volumes are creating pretty quick, and you can notice them on Azure, for example, in your resource group as actual resource of data disk. So you can always check that they're healthy, up and running, and so I haven't seen this issue.
And the premium storage, it's quite fast. It feels like it's speedy.
It does. That's what I've tried for my demo. Managed premium storage, yep.
And how long did it take you to get, like you said you used Cassandra, to get that up and running on Kubernetes on Azure?
Well, I had previous experience with both Kubernetes and Cassandra. So it took me about, I think, a few hours to get this up and running.
Wow.
So, yeah.
That's pretty exciting.
Yeah.
So does this mean that, and this might be a silly sentence, but can we start using Kubernetes for basically anything? Could I take all kinds of apps that don't belong in Kubernetes and put them in Kubernetes, and they'll be just fine?
Well, I would say I've been trying this for development purposes because, of course, there will be... So when you run a production database or production system with state, you expect some sort of performance from it. So when you run it on bare metal, you will, of course, have more speed and you have more expectations from it. The benefit of doing distributed database on Kubernetes is that you can easily get started with it. You don't have to, you can easily remove it. You don't have to pay for the service to be running because it's really hard to create it and delete it. So when you have a bare metal cluster, you will just have it for your in development and testing purposes and production. And it's hard to do everything with it because it's up and running and you don't want to touch it and it's expensive. With Kubernetes, you have the benefit of spooling this up quickly, being able to be flexible and get rid of it at any moment you want and then create it very easily. So you don't have to overpay for your resources. So you can benefit from it right now for dev and test, but with production, I would probably wait a little bit because there might be some issues because the technology is still pretty new and there are still some issues on GitHub regarding some corner cases and edge cases that are now being worked on.
Yeah, I think the question that everyone wants to know is when Kubernetes will be kind of like stop moving so fast, because it always feels like there's just a couple of little things that might change from minor point to minor point. You know?
I feel like Kubernetes right now is going through its stage of growth because everybody notices that it is useful and we still don't have the ecosystem and standards in the same way and in the same quality that we had for VMs and usual, not containerized applications. Mm-hmm. So the community is very vibrant. And at KubeCon in December, I was shocked by number of little projects that are in Kubernetes ecosystem related to everything, like observability, logging, distributed tracing, machine learning. And this all starts to appear around Kubernetes. And I completely agree that it's hard to keep track of it, but it is a necessary stage of development for a tool that will finally probably obtain some sort of stability eventually.
Mm-hmm. So if we kind of pop a few things off the stack and go back to F-sharp and functional programming and your language of preference, when you take, you know, Cassandra, which you like, Docker, Azure, and Kubernetes, and then you add F-sharp on top of them, does the immutable functional world of F-sharp fit really well into the stateless and scalable world of Kubernetes?
It does fit pretty well. On Kubernetes, I can mix and match languages that I use on Kubernetes. So I'm using multiple languages for my services. I can use Scala in one service, F-sharp in another service. So whatever is more suitable for a piece of functionality that I'm deploying. But I agree that functional programming is really fitting into the distributed systems paradigm as well. And it's interesting to basically also go deeper in how Kubernetes is built and see how scheduling is made. So if we look into components of Kubernetes ecosystem, there is an etcd server, which is like a key value store, the cluster database. And then we have API server that accesses etcd. We have basically controllers that is like an infinite reconciliation loop pattern that checks for our state that is we have currently and the desired state, and then compares it and makes our current state the same as desired state. And then scheduling pods. And if we look at algorithms that are used underneath in distributed systems, we can see that a lot of them are actually functional. If we look at distributed commit log that Kafka uses or that Spark uses, we can see that they're all based on the concept of immutability and how two worlds collide together.
That's an interesting point. Have you seen, I'm sure you have, Julia Evans, Kubernetes zines and
yes.
and comics?
Yes, I have. I'm a big fan of her diagrams, I would say.
Yeah, I was looking at them while you were describing how, you know, etcd and scheduling and all that kind of things work. And it definitely, I would recommend it to folks when you're listening to this podcast or when you're learning about Kubernetes and distributed systems. Julia Evans, as she is learning, is drawing a lot of these things up in a very, very clever kind of comic book zine kind of way, which is cool.
Exactly.
So thinking about F-sharp in the future, I know that we've got F-sharp roadmaps published from August. We've got .NET Standard 2.0 coming. You were saying that functional programming really lends itself to this new world. If you think about microservices, or people are now telling me that they want even smaller services, I don't know, Pico services or nano services, making a function distributed.
Yeah. People are trying to experiment with the amount of code they put into services. And I see that functions are becoming pretty popular when you want to have some event trigger and trigger an execution of a function. Like you can use Azure Functions or AWS Lambda. And F-sharp is supported. So it was one of the first languages that was supported by these tools. So you have many options to do that.
Have you looked at OpenFAS, FAAS, Functions as a Service?
I have not.
A couple of weeks ago, like I mentioned, we had Alex Ellis on, and he's basically making it's like Azure Functions, except it's open. It's his own Azure Functions. And then we've also seen Azure Functions runtime released. So you could go and run the Azure Functions runtime on another cloud as a container if you wanted to.
That sounds cool. I also see a lot of technologies shift into streaming and stream processing. So we have IoT devices and various devices that have sensors or anything similar to that, and they have a lot of data. So I have noticed that use of technologies like Kafka and Spark streaming increased dramatically in the last few years. Because there is a need to gather data from various sources, and they can come in with different speed. They can be produced from different producers, and then we have multiple consumers that are independent of each other, and we need to somehow manage the two parts of this process, producing and consuming. We need the in-between layer to be durable, because anything can happen to these events. So I've noticed a big increase of usage in technologies like Kafka and Spark streaming, where basically, I've tried it on Azure on HD Insight and Databricks, and it works amazing. And it basically integrates with a lot of existing tools. So just another trend that appears to be popular.
So doing something like Kafka, and that's K-A-F-K-A, and people can go and check it out at kafka.apache.org, and we've also got Kafka on Azure. This is much more custom than just what we did in the old days, which was put a bunch of stuff in a SQL Server table and then read it from somewhere else. Like, that doesn't scale very much in a distributed system, does it?
It does not, because we have this problem of needing to collect data from different sources. It can be a database or like a database table that populates with different speed, or we can have events that come in from various systems. So, and we need to somehow integrate these multiple sources. And if we do it by writing separate pieces for each of them, it becomes unmanageable. And then we have to basically write the same code for every system. Not the same, but similar code for all the systems. And then we have to solve problems like durability, scalability, where they are all solved in Kafka. If you learn how to use it, you'll be able to basically have a reliable, scalable commit log of events that you don't have to consume right away, because it's durable. It has a retention period. And can have a flexible number of consumers, and it solves all the problems that appear in the multiple event, multiple data sources problem.
It seems like, and I'll put some words in your mouth and you tell me if this is correct, that you're an advocate in distributed systems of definitely not reinventing the wheel. Like if there's a problem, you don't need to necessarily write that yourself. There's something that will do it for you.
That is true, because there are a lot of systems that already solve really hard problems. You can try to solve it yourself, but you will notice the pattern that other tools already implement. And if you look into the code, mm-hmm. you will see that it is not very trivial. So like when you look at the websites of the most popular databases or distributed systems, you see that they say fault tolerant, scalable, fast, low latency. Mm-hmm. And all of these words are very abstract. So you know that they're good. They mean that your system is going to work. Cool. But for real, they mean different things. So there is a lot of non-triviality in how it is implemented. So there is consensus algorithms to make sure that your events and next step of your replication or anything that requires coordination is performed in order and there are no conflicts. There is configuration exchange where there are things like gossip and algorithms for mm-hmm. metadata exchange like Cassandra cluster uses or React. And there are many other things to ensure that your consistency across the cluster is correct. Because there are mistakes in replication, and sometimes we have to fix them. So we need to know about things like hinted handoff or read repair or anti-entropy repair. So, and when you go and surf through the internet for how to do this and that, you basically are sucked into a bunch of distributed system papers that are very formal and hard to read. But then you start to realize that all of these existing solutions already implement them and, you know, start noticing patterns and see that this word, like fault tolerance, actually means these algorithms. So if you create a new distributed system that does not implement something that is already implemented, then you will have to know all of these things.
That's very well said. I appreciate that. Thanks so much for chatting with me today.
Thank you.
Folks can check out Lena at twitter.com/lenadroid and lenadroid.github.io. She's got a ton of great information on distributed systems and Azure and large scale and functional programming. And I appreciate you. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.